Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today was a day to take stock, to sit back and figure out exactly what happened Friday morning when the Fed cut the discount rate. Wall Street spent some time dithering between happy and sad. Traders finally came out ahead. But just because Bernanke acts doesn't mean that troubles are over. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, online at shrm.org. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's Monday, the 20th of August. Good to have you with us. For the first time in what seems like forever, a turbulent stock market isn't the lead story of the day for us today. Investors were generally mellow as they tried to make up their minds about what lies ahead. There were some troubling indicators, though, and they sprang from the source of all the problems to begin with, the mortgage industry. The subprime lender Luminant agreed to sell a majority stake in itself this morning at bargain basement prices just to find the cash to stay in business. Thornburg Mortgages, known for its prime jumbo home loans, let go of more than $20 billion in primo mortgage-backed securities today. And the lending giant Countrywide, the one that's been hammered for its subprime exposure, has started laying off some of its workers. Stacey Vanek Smith has the details.
Storm clouds are gathering over mortgage companies right now, and it's a world full of fair weather lenders. Christopher Thornburg is with Beacon Economics. He says the banks and hedge funds that normally loan money to mortgage companies to make their loans have turned off the spigot.
People who have money in these mortgage companies are now recognizing the fact that their money is at severe risk. And so they are rapidly trying to yank their money out of the system, and that's creating a liquidity crisis.
That has all mortgage companies scrambling for cash. And if they don't get it fast, they can't survive, says Columbia Business School's Chris Mayer.
If you're having a hard time originating new loans, you're not going to be able to cover your overhead, and your future profits look bleak.
To get cash fast, the severely troubled Luminant Mortgage Capital announced today that it had sold off a big chunk of itself at a discount price. Thornburg Mortgage is in better shape, but reportedly sold more than $20 billion worth of its best assets at a loss. Lending giant and industry bellwether Countrywide is slashing staff. So all three lenders have cash for now, but Mayer says the future looks bleak for mortgage lenders and the rest of the economy.
The loss of liquidity in the mortgage market, I think, is a huge recession risk for the U.S.
Mayer says it's hard to get a mortgage loan right now, but if things don't improve, it could be difficult for consumers to get any kind of credit, from car loans to student loans. He said that would wreak havoc on the U.S. economy. Mayer says for the moment, all eyes are on Countrywide. The mortgage mammoth generates about 20% of all mortgage loans in the U.S. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Senate Finance Committee Chairman and Democratic presidential hopeful Christopher Dodd weighed in on the credit squeeze today. Dodd said he's going to meet tomorrow with Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. The senator added he's hoping for a candid conversation about where things are headed. We thought we'd beat him to the punch, not with the Fed chairman, but with Jeffrey Sott, chief investment strategist at Raymond James. Mr. Sott, good to have you here.
My pleasure.
If you look at some of the things that have been happening today, Countrywide talking about layoffs and Thornburg having its problems, I mean, we're not done yet, are we?
I don't think you're going to know the outcome of this for a minimum of 60 to 90 days and probably longer.
And what's going to happen during those 60 to 90 days? Are we going to see more volatility in market swings? Are we going to see more rate cuts, all of those things?
I think you're going to see all of those things. The uncertainty out there and the not being able to properly value certain pieces of fixed income paper will create more volatility.
Okay, but volatility sort of begets volatility. What brings it to an end?
When something can't go on forever, it won't.
And that's it. Thus works the economy.
Well, you know, these things, if the people would just step back and let the free marketplace rectify its own ills, you'd probably have a resolution quicker. But the Federal Reserve, being the lender of last resort, so to speak, I really believe that they thought some major financial institution was in trouble and they needed to do something both psychologically and liquidity-wise right then, last Thursday evening, Friday morning, to prevent a large body from floating. It's like 1998. The markets kept going down. They'd try to rally, wouldn't get very far. They'd go down more, try to rally, they wouldn't get very far. And then you finally saw the dead body float to the surface, and it was long-term capital management.
Do we necessarily know anything more than we did Friday morning when Mr. Bernanke made his move?
I think you can take it for granted that somebody was pretty worried about the financial contagion that's been going on for the past few months.
Well, then lay it out for me. Give me some specifics.
I think you're going to see more interest rate cuts. I think you'll see the Fed cut the Fed funds rate at the September meeting. I don't think they'll do it before that unless the contagion spins out of control. And I think they will continue to lower interest rates until they see some abatement in the spreading contagion.
Do you think it's worked? Do you think that discount rate cut Friday morning has worked?
In the very short term, it's probably worked. But again, I think you're going to have to see, you know, some more casualties and some more collateral damage before we get this thing in the rearview mirror.
What's that going to look like for everybody else? Forget about Wall Street for a second. What about everybody else?
Well, it right now it's unknowable. I think it really does depend on whether the contagion spreads into an economic slowdown or potentially even a recession. I mean, where are all these people that 6 months ago were telling us there was a 15 or 20% chance of a recession? If those forecasts were even generally correct, the odds of a recession have to be higher now than they were 6 months ago.
Jeffrey Sott is Chief Investment Strategist at Raymond James. Mr. Sott, thanks for your time.
It's our pleasure.
Until last Monday, probably not too many of you had heard of the Sentinel Management Group. That was when the fund company out in Illinois announced it was freezing its accounts. Late Friday night, Sentinel filed for bankruptcy protection. Today, the SEC said it's filing civil fraud charges against the company. That Sentinel ran money market funds is what makes the news particularly surprising. Money markets are supposed to be some of the safest investments out there. They pay better interest than a typical savings account without much more risk, or at least that's what investors had been led to believe. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports some money market funds have been investing in some dangerous debt.
Money market fund managers get paid to play it safe. But as of June, funds managed by the likes of Bank of America and Fidelity held more than $6 billion in securities backed by subprime debt, so says Bloomberg News. Louise Pirtle is chief strategist at research firm Credit Sites. She says many of these securities were pronounced almost risk-free by ratings agencies. But now so many borrowers have defaulted on subprime mortgages, Pirtle says the investments don't appear so safe. After all,
we now have a situation where a lot of these assets are far less liquid and far less secure than the money managers who invested in them believed them to be.
Now, Pirtle says money market fund managers are ditching all kinds of commercial debt in favor of safer U.S. Treasury bonds. Jim Barth is a fellow at the Milken Institute, an economic think tank. He says what people call a flight to quality creates a whole different problem.
If everybody does that, of course, what that does is bids up the prices of treasuries, as we've seen, and lowers the return on treasuries.
Lower returns mean less interest for investors in money market funds. Today, yields on short-term T-bills dropped more than they had in 20 years. But if you discover your money market fund invested in mortgage-backed securities, Barth says don't panic. For one thing, it's probably a small fraction of the portfolio, and the industry depends on the belief that for every dollar investors put in, they'll get at least a dollar back. Analysts say money managers will even take a hit to their own fees to make that happen. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I guess it was just a good news, bad news day all over the place. Equities bounced around a bit, as I mentioned. So did oil. The National Hurricane Center is betting Hurricane Dean will miss U.S. oil rigs and refineries down along the Gulf of Mexico. But the Mexican state oil company Pemex shut down 80% of its production. Crude settled at $71.12 a barrel today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Environmentalists went toe to baton with British police near London today. Heathrow Airport's planning a big expansion, adding a third runway. And climate change activists have been protesting all week. They want growth in international air travel cut back and the carbon dioxide from all those extra airplanes stopped before it even gets started. Of course, the UK is not the only country trying to come up with a solution for global warming. When Congress gets back to work next month, lawmakers will plow through more than a half a dozen proposals that would put a cap on greenhouse gas emissions. But there is another idea that industry leaders and some economists are starting to pay attention to, a carbon tax. We asked Sam Eaton from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk to look into the differences between tax and cap.
California Democrat Barbara Boxer is the Senate's gatekeeper for any proposals that would mandate cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. And she knows exactly what she wants.
I think cap and trade makes the most sense.
Most politicians who support federal action on global warming favor a cap and trade system. It would set a limit on the total emissions U.S. industries can spew into the atmosphere. Those that find affordable ways to cut pollution would be able to monetize those cuts and sell them as credits to industries that can't change. That's music to the ears of Sun Microsystems. Boxer recently toured the tech company's new super-efficient server farm in California's Silicon Valley.
Okay. We're going to start over here so we get you an overview.
We enter a room the size of a giant supermarket. It's filled with rows of computer servers. Cooling them takes lots of electricity. But Sun has found a way to cut its power use in half. Boxer says under a cap and trade system, the company could cash in on these changes.
When we pass legislation to combat global warming, we will not be hurting this economy. We will be helping it.
But the gatekeeper for global warming legislation in the House, Democrat John Dingell, doesn't share Boxer's rosy outlook.
This is going to be tough, and it's going to cost, and it's going to hurt.
Dingell's Michigan constituents are a long way from California's high-tech economy. The Rust Belt's automakers and other heavy industries see only losses in a cap-and-trade scenario. Cutting vehicle and industrial emissions can cost a lot more than redesigning server farms. Dingell says to be fair, the economic pain must be shared, all the way down to the consumer. And he says the way to do that is to tax anything that produces too much CO2.
In my view, probably the only thing that will really work. In all honesty, I'm not convinced that if you don't change people's behavior, you're going to change the way they behave.
The idea is gaining an ideologically diverse group of followers, everyone from Al Gore to ExxonMobil. The potential volatility of a carbon market scares some businesses. It's much better, they argue, to pay a steady and predictable price for polluting in the form of a tax. Vicky Arroyo with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change says that misses the point.
The price is not what we're trying to achieve. It's the environmental goal that we're trying to achieve.
Arroyo says taxes don't set any limits on how much industries can pollute. But under a cap and trade system, firm targets for emissions reductions are built in, ensuring a more predictable outcome. She says there's even room for surprises.
It encourages continuous innovation. You don't just meet a standard and stop. You want to actually meet the standard and beat it, because then you'll be in a position to sell those credits on the market.
And Arroyo says that's a carrot many businesses might just bite. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Ordinarily, if you want to see a fine work of art, you'd have to go to the nearest museum. Commentator Sandra Tsing Lo found a happy compromise, but as she tells us in this edition of The Lowdown, now she's caught up in the age-old struggle against buyer's remorse.
True confession. The other week, I had a couple of glasses of wine too many and did something I was shocked by in the morning. At a silent auction, I bought a Picasso. For perspective, understand that I am generally considered to be the world's cheapest person. I am the only wife whose husband has actually said to her, "Please, I beg you to go to the mall and buy new clothes." Recently, I got my hair cut for the first time in 4 years. And I mean professionally cut, not like when my 2-year-old put her electric train in my hair and the wheels were literally grinding into my scalp. Hanana, hanana, hanana. And my husband had to cut the train out. No, no, no. This was actually in a salon. I should also note up front that I paid just $1,350 for the Picasso, as it is actually a lithograph. On the one hand, I couldn't believe you could buy a Picasso for under $75 million. On the other hand, even its cheapness makes me anxious. I mean, what is a lithograph but a fancy word for reproduction? I'm half afraid I'll turn around and find this Picasso at Target. Upon getting it home, to take nothing away from the Spanish master, what makes the piece of art stand out from the wall, what gives it a throbbing, almost electric aura, is less the drawing itself than the actual glass over the drawing, the plate glass. It is so unsmeared with jelly, so pristine, so shiny, it actually reflects. And I realize how long a time it's been since I've seen really clean glass. Rather like the astigmatism of Van Gogh, my world does not look like the world of others. No, my landscapes are seen through a haze of dirty car windows, Vaseline-smeared mirrors, even my filthy sunglasses. And I turn in slow motion and looked at the smudged walls and family junk of our house, and I realize with a sinking feeling that you can put the Picasso in Van Nuys, but you cannot take the Van Nuys out of us. In short, now we have to remodel. Oh, well, as I can see in the glass, I still have a pretty good haircut until 2011.
Sandra Tsinglo lives and shops right here in Los Angeles. Send us your thoughts if you get a chance. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, would you trust your money to a man covered in tattoos?
They might look at me weird for a minute, but as soon as, you know, I explain to them what I know and what I've done, they see dollar signs.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 0.3%, 42 points to 13,121. The NASDAQ inched up 0.1%, 3 points to 2,508. The S&P 500 was down just a tick to 1,445. Home improvement chain Lowe's nailed a 6% gain after it predicted good sales for the year. Mining firm Freeport-McMoRan hiked 4% as copper prices rose. Financial firms were beaten back down again today. Deutsche Bank was down 2%. Goldman Sachs fell 1.25%. Countrywide Financial that we told you about flopped another 7.5% today. Bonds traded up, though, the yield on the 10-year T-note eased to 4.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Ever hear a song on Marketplace but you just can't place it? Or maybe it's the first time you've heard it and you want to hear it again. Just click on the archive section of our website. We list the songs we play on every show in that day's rundown. There's even a link to an online store where you can buy the song and help fund public radio programming. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. President Bush flies to Minneapolis for a briefing on the I-35 bridge collapse. NASA plans to bring Space Shuttle Endeavour back to Earth, concluding this closely watched mission a day early due to weather concerns. Endeavour's first landing opportunity will be at Kennedy Space Center. And the U.S. increased its tropical Sandy Beach territory when Hawaii became the 50th state on August 21, 1959. Aloha, I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Whether or not you're of an age to qualify for Medicare coverage, this next story could still be of some interest to you. Medicare is set to publish some new rules this week covering how it pays for hospital care, or perhaps how it won't pay. Starting next year, the government health program for seniors will pay providers more for treating sicker patients, but less if hospitals make mistakes that make patients sicker. Helen Palmer reports now from the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH. Medicare is about the 800-pound gorilla of medical payers, which means other insurers will surely follow suit.
For too long, Medicare's just been the big daddy that pays the $400 billion a year bill.
What we really want to do is become an active purchaser of care.
Herb Kuhn is Medicare's acting deputy administrator. He says this payment reform is part of Medicare's push towards quality care. Why should they pay for mistakes that should never happen?
Things like infections, urinary tract infections, and also what are the so-called never events, like objects left in the body during surgery.
Kuhn says evidence and practice show events like this are preventable. This new rule uses the payment system to make sure 8 specific bad outcomes are prevented. Consumer groups are cheering. Robert Hayes of the Medicare Rights Center.
For the federal government to step in and say, whoa, we are going to put some heavy pressure on hospitals to start following the accepted practices that make better health care and better health care outcomes is a very positive thing.
Hayes warns there's a risk hospitals will start aggressive testing when patients are admitted to prove that, say, an infection they developed there had some cause other than sloppy hospital practices. And the American Hospital Association's Nancy Foster says the new Medicare payment rules may not actually make things better.
Not every complication is preventable.
Foster says, for example, falls that cause injury are on Medicare's list of preventable events. But patients who are confused or have just had surgery may try to get out of bed and injure themselves, and there just aren't enough nurses to watch every patient 24/7. Private plans haven't decided yet when they'll follow Medicare's example, but Susan Pisanu of the insurer's lobby says it makes sense.
Paying the same for good quality as you pay for bad quality really provides the wrong incentives. The idea is that if you pay for quality, you will improve quality.
And, of course, you'll save cash, too. Infection-preventing moves like frequent hand-washing and using sterile drapes are relatively cheap. And Medicare's Herb Kuhn sees considerable savings.
We're looking at savings of around $20 million per year.
And the rule that will bring the savings also mandates that the extra costs can't be passed on to patients. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Every summer about this time, the same thought strikes me after a couple of months of short sleeves and tank tops. You get a good idea of just how many people in this country have tattoos. Clearly, body art's becoming more acceptable everywhere from college campuses to the boardroom, as Pat Loeb found out.
I got a skull and crossbones on my right side. I have praying hands on my left side and then a cross in the middle.
James O'Connor is giving me a tour of the tattoos that adorn, it looks like, every part of his body. Neck, legs, knuckles, and full sleeves on his arms.
He calls this stretch skin, cheese skin, where it's supposed to look like you're almost looking inside, you know.
But the most astonishing moment comes when he tells me what he does for a living.
I'm a mortgage broker.
If ever there was evidence of the changing attitude toward tattoos in the workplace, it is 30-year-old James O'Connor. There was a time when his tattoos would have narrowed his job prospects. But he says his success as a mortgage broker is a sign that tattoos do not carry the stigma they once did.
They might look at me weird for a minute, but as soon as, you know, I explain to them what I know and what I've done, they see dollar signs.
Numbers alone are forcing more employers to hire tattooed workers. A Northwestern University study last year found 36% of 18 to 29-year-olds have tattoos, compared to 15% of 40 to 50-year-olds. Perry Smith is a Southern California attorney who specializes in employment law.
The employers will be more tolerant because of their need to recruit candidates and good employees. And because such a large percentage of the younger workforce has tattoos and piercings, they're going to have to accommodate these things.
Smith compares it to the gradual acceptance of long hair on men. He says as the younger generation matures in the workforce, tattoos just won't matter.
Sooner or later, the guys who have the tattoos will be making the policies and things will change.
Smith emphasizes that change is slow. He says companies still have every right to deny employment or fire people because of tattoos. Some places have specific policies prohibiting visible tattoos. Resorts like Disneyland, some camps, daycare centers, police departments, and the U.S. military are among them. Even employers who are loosening their standards on tattoos prefer them small and discreet. Dr. Fardad Farouzanpour recently okayed a new tattoo for a surgical fellow at his Beverly Hills Cosmetic Surgical Group, but within limits.
As far as a workplace that you're trying to give a professional image, I'd like to have it, at least if it's visible, something that is tasteful with maybe nothing that brings or offends anybody.
Which brings us back to James O'Connor, the mortgage broker. He's in the process of getting several of his tattoos removed. He recently had the words "lose hope" taken off of his knuckles.
I'm very conservative in some ways, in work and stuff like that, I'm very conservative, but then in other ways, you know, you see me and people wouldn't think that. And that's probably part of the reason I want to get some of them, you know, removed, is just so my image fits more with what, you know, I feel like I am.
O'Connor adds that getting his tattoos removed will be good for business. In Los Angeles, I'm Pat Loeb for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, heading into the last couple of weeks of summer, one last look now at some beach books with a business twist. Over the past week, we heard some of our regular commentators offer their picks for business books that won't make you fall asleep at the beach. Today, some listener suggestions.
Hi there. My name is David Lander. I live in Floyd, Virginia. My favorite business beach book is The Success Effect by John Ekberg. One of the stories that stood out from the book was the guy who was down on his knees teaching people how to clean toilets and realized there has to be a better way, and then came up with a system for cleaning toilets better. Somehow, that was really quite a journey he made to making a lot of money and doing some good.
I'm Logan Ward. I live in Stanton, Virginia, and the book I've chosen is called Hetty, The Genius and Madness of America's First Female Tycoon. This is a story of someone who, if they've heard of Hetty, they may have the wrong impression of her. I guess she's best known as the Witch of Wall Street, but she also had this innate sense of buy low, sell high, which is one of the simplest financial maxims, but she practiced it her whole life, and I think that was her simple secret.
Hi, my name is Meg Wilson, and I teach science and technology at the University of Texas, and the book that I'm recommending is Systems of Survival by Jane Jacobs. Systems of Survival is a conversation about the different perspectives that business people have and that nonprofit people have. Around us, there's kind of a fan club. We buy Systems of Survival by bulk, and we just hand them out like candy to people. When we start a conversation and we get into these issues, we go the next step, and I hand them a copy, and I hear, here, take it, read it.
You can get the whole list from our commentators and other listener suggestions on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace for this afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 42 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ tiptoed up 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 1.25 points, just under 0.1%. Our producers include Megan Larson, Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, finding new ways to handle a growing population of sick seniors.
It's older folks who break their hips. It's older people who have heart disease. So every doctor who has contact with older patients needs to know how to take care of those older patients in the larger sense.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.